This is Radio Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins. The defense team for Zhohar Tsarnaev lays out reasons it believes the Boston Marathon bomber should be spared execution. It points to two key figures in Tsarnaev's life, his mother and his deceased brother.
And they're going to be portrayed as these really dominant figures and characters in this family. And the Zhohar is sort of hopelessly caught between the sway of a mother who's really lost it and a brother who he looks up to.
Boston police are investigating an officer who aggressively pushed a toy gun in front of a man who was filming the police.
See that?
Yeah.
See that?
Yeah.
That's why we're here.
Okay.
Have a good day.
Okay. All
Bye.
Right.
Prosecutors in Baltimore are taking action against six police officers in connection with the death of 25-year-old Freddie Gray.
We have probable cause to file criminal charges.
Yes! Yes!
And a former FBI agent is facing criminal charges over his testimony in the trial of James Whitey Bulger. Some criminal defense attorneys say prosecutors are retaliating against a whistleblower.
He has been punished for coming into court and defying the government.
We'll cover all of that and more in our Week in Review today. Joining us on our panel, Nancy Gertner. She's former federal judge and teaches at Harvard Law School. Hello, Nancy.
Hello.
Nice to have you back again. Also with us, Boston Globe columnist Jeff Jacoby. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Lisa.
Okay, we're starting off with Zhohar Tsarnaev. We are trying to, or the defense, we should say, is trying to paint a picture of a young, impressionable boy, somebody who was persuaded by his older brother, Tamerlan, to place a bomb near the finish line of the Boston Marathon 2 years ago. Let's hear first from Kevin Cullen, the Boston Globe columnist. He's talking about the defense strategy with WBUR's David Boeri in our Finish Line podcast.
What the defense is going to do is lay out all these people who knew Tamerlan, and he's going to come across as this social misfit, this fundamentalist person who just turned and tried to turn everybody around him toward this worldview of which Islamic people were being persecuted across the world. And then we're going to contrast that describing Zhohar as just this average kid, this kid that was very sociably engaged. He wasn't talking about extreme forms of religion or anything like that. He was the captain of the wrestling team. The juxtaposition of these two brothers is going to be so stark by the time the defense finishes.
Okay, that's Kevin Cullen once again. The jury also heard testimony from people who knew Tamerlan and knew Zhohar. Nancy Gertner, how effective do you think this argument is?
It's hard to know at this point. You understand that it comes after the first images that the jury has seen has been sort of this blast of the horror show of the crime. So the question is whether or not that the jury would be listening to this filling out the portrait of Zhohar or not. I keep on thinking that what's really the subtext here is if the jury had Tamerlan and Zhohar in front of them, the chances that the government would go for the death penalty for Zhohar, it seems to me, are slim to none. The chances that if the jury had both in front of them, that they would give it to Tamerlan and not Zhohar are very substantial. And so to a degree, what the defense is doing is recreating that scenario. If Tamerlan were here, wouldn't he be the one to get the death penalty and not the younger brother?
And are you saying that because it sounds like you're saying the defense has been so far pretty effective in its argument that Zhohar was under the influence of Tamerlan?
It's been effective. It's hard to know what the impact on the jury has been. You understand that this is a jury that doesn't really look like the rest of eastern Massachusetts. This is a jury that was death qualified. So it's very difficult to understand how they're filtering this. Our perceptions of it are not necessarily theirs.
Right. Death qualified meaning that the jury has said every juror had to say that he or she would at least consider issuing the death penalty. Jeff Jacoby, what's your view?
Well, first of all, it's certainly true that you can't tell exactly how this will appeal to how the argument will play with the jury. The defense knows that all they have to do is get one member of this jury to at least be open to the idea that the death penalty is not an appropriate penalty. But in this particular case, and really for people like me who are death penalty supporters, the argument is never everyone who's on trial for capital murder needs to get the death penalty, or that the death penalty is always the appropriate punishment. Rather, for people like me, the argument would be the death penalty in cases where the law allows it should be one of the possible range of penalties that a jury and the judge are able to consider. So this notion about the death qualification of a jury somehow skewing it or making it not like the rest of the people in eastern Massachusetts, it seems to me that injects an argument that that you wouldn't apply in any other circumstance. If you have somebody who's a potential juror in a regular, you know, some other case, a non-capital case, who says that he is vehemently opposed to incarceration. He thinks that prisons are terrible places. He doesn't believe that it's civilized to lock people up in cages. And no matter what happens, he would never agree to punish someone who's convicted with a prison sentence. What prosecuting attorney would even have to raise the objection before the judge would say, okay, thank you, Mr. Potential Juror, you're not qualified to sit in this jury? We wouldn't say it in any other case. So to say that when you're talking about the death penalty, that yes, a jury's agreeing to consider what the law permits it to consider,
I think it's a fair question. I don't mean that. We don't ask the imprisonment question. So therefore, we don't have the opportunity to skew the jury in the way death qualification does. No, I look at this more as an issue of whether this ought to have been a death penalty in the first instance, whether this ought to have been a death recommendation in the first instance, because the distance between
which people can disagree about
the distance between this jury's attitudes and the attitudes of Boston and the attitudes of Eastern Massachusetts is much wider than in your usual death penalty case because of the nature of Boston, and that goes to the prosecutor's discretion rather than the legitimacy of asking the question.
So right, but it's United States versus Tsarnaev. It's not Eastern Massachusetts or Boston versus Tsarnaev.
No, it's true. That's
okay.
True.
So let's look at what the defense argued this week. Though David Brook argued that it would be better to lock Johar away for the rest of his life than to execute him. Here's what David Boeri said. He was quoting Brook here.
He says, "The man who conceived, planned, and led these crimes is beyond our power. Only the 19-year-old younger brother is left. And then, frankly," he says to them, "there is no evening of the scales, no point in trying to hurt him as he hurt, because it can't be done. If you sentence him to life without parole, it will be punishment that will protect society."
So as David Boeri points out, the defense attorney went on to point out that Tsarnaev would not be heard from ever again if he's locked away for the rest of his life. There's no chance of parole. He would be spending the rest of his life at the Supermax prison in Colorado. There were some portraits of that prison that were pretty disgusting. What is the point in detailing how rough a life sentence for Johar would be?
Well, I would guess that it's a kind of reverse psychology that's taking place here. Maybe the defense figures that Tsarnaev is presenting such an unpleasant image that there is nothing whatsoever humanizable about him. The guy who gives the finger on camera, that no matter how hard they try, they're not going to make him seem sweet and lovable and the innocent dupe of his nasty, mean older brother. So maybe there's a reverse psychology going on here. Yes, members of the jury, you're right to think that this is a terrible person who deserves the worst you can do to him. And actually, the worst he could do to him is to send him away to prison for life. Perhaps there's a strategy like that.
Nancy Gertner, does that work?
Well, I think it certainly works. It works, and actually, the vast majority of federal death penalty prosecutions have led to a determination of life. So it absolutely works. And I think that part of it's also saying it's not that you're talking about excusing. You're talking about punishment. It's only a question of which punishment that you're imposing on him, and don't think that he's going to get off easy if life is the alternative here. I think that that's what's going on.
By the way, does it matter, and do we know what Johar himself would prefer?
We have no idea.
And does it matter?
I don't think it doesn't matter because it doesn't figure into anything. It doesn't figure into what the... Well, let me put it this way. We do know one thing. We know that the defense would have pled to life without parole in a nanosecond. We do know that by now. That's uncontrovertible. So he clearly, to the extent that the lawyers reflect his preference, he has that preference.
Okay, for both of you, the relatives of Johar Tsarnaev are expected to testify next week. There's been a lot of talk about this and what might happen. I wonder for both of you what kind of questions you're hoping they can answer. Nancy?
Well, I mean, I think that the pictures of Johar when he was a young man, I think the questions are to try to describe the sort of arc of this family from relatively functional to dysfunctional, and the arc of this family in the United States and what he was facing. But again, I mean, the critical issue is that you don't want to make it, you're not excusing, you're explaining, and that is essential in this.
Okay, Jeff.
You know, I'm remembering things that were said in the days after the attack first took place. Nobody had to go back to what their life was like when they were young boys. I remember people, even indeed in this studio, talking about how, as a student at the school in Cambridge, this was an amiable kid, and right at Ringen Latin in Cambridge, he was an amiable kid with lots of friends, and his Cambridge classmates were posting supportive messages on his Facebook page. It seems to me we all have black stuff and light stuff in our backgrounds, and you can always find something to use to explain or to hook a bad decision on. But in the end, he's an adult. He has the same choices and the same free will that the rest of us do. When you put an explosive, a bag full of explosives, you know, a few feet away from a little boy, it's hard to say that this is all because, you had a brother who was pushing you around, or because your family got into arguments with you. That wasn't the Jihar Tsarnaev that people remembered in the days right after the attack. I wonder how effective an argument that'll prove.
I mean, the death penalty, it's a relative determination. In other words, you're saying, how is he relative to others who are similarly situated? And the fact that he is younger, the fact that there is an oppressive older brother and an oppressive mother, makes him relatively less culpable than those who have gotten the death penalty without those issues. It's not an absolute determination. As I said, it's a relative determination. And these things count to put him on a continuum towards life rather than death.
Okay. Turning to our next issue now. This is a very interesting story that's just breaking. A Boston police sergeant is under investigation after an aggressive encounter with a man from Attleboro who was recording a police stop that happened in Roxbury. That's where the police confiscated what turned out to be a toy gun. The police sergeant, Henry Staines, apparently walked over to the man who was recording this, and he put the confiscated toy gun in front of the man's lens. Let's hear now from the video.
This is why we're here.
And I don't know why you're here.
We have a close video of this. See that?
Yeah.
See that?
Yeah.
That's why we're here.
Okay.
Have a good day.
Okay. All right.
So it's important to note that this is the toy gun, the side of the toy gun, not the barrel pointed at the man. It's not clear who knew that it was a toy gun at that point or not, certainly not the man behind the camera. Boston Police Commissioner Bill Evans is calling the video disturbing. He says that he's sending out a memo reminding all officers that citizens have a right to film them. Here he is speaking to New England Cable News.
Sergeant Staines is very embarrassed over this. He's all apology. He knows he messed up, and he's willing to take what discipline is going to be imposed.
Nancy Gertner, what are you thinking about this?
Given what we have seen the past couple of months about the significance of videotaping police-civilian encounters, it seems to me that this has to be dealt with very clearly. In other words, citizens have a right to do it, to videotape, and it has been incredibly salutary to see the videos. In each of the cases that we've watched on television, there's been a script that the officer, not all officers, but certainly those that we've seen, the officer will say, I'm in fear of my life, that's why I shot, that's why I punched, whatever. And then we see supervisors saying, oh yes, he was in fear of his life, and it was only because a video came out that exposed that we have a real conversation about police-civilian encounters. So this is not just something that citizens will have fun doing. This is something that it seems like a good thing to do.
You know, I tend to agree, and I would say that in this case...
Oh, my God. Let me reconsider my question.
and in this case, I think the speed with which the police officer has been slapped down is welcome. Apparently, he was required today, or will be required today or tomorrow, to go and personally apologize to the guy who had the phone out and who was recording. It's worth remembering that this is a relatively new development. I don't mean in the law, but I mean, first of all, the idea that, you know, that everybody, except those like me who don't carry smartphones, but that everybody else in the world can just whip out something from their pocket at any point and start videotaping.
And it's legal. Is this correct is legal to videotape a police officer? Is it legal to videotape just a common citizen walking down the road?
It is, absolutely.
If you're in public, sure. Video or audio tape.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, there are specific restrictions on recording conversations if one party doesn't know he's being recorded and it's on the telephone. But
and if one party doesn't know he or she's being videoed?
Actually, not. Not that I know of.
Yeah, I don't think there is any kind of...
I mean, if you've exposed yourself to public in the sense of if you're walking down the street, then you can be videoed. I mean, what Jeff is saying is we actually have rules about overhearing conversations, which were for the most part dealing with wiretapping kinds of or phone conversations. I'm not certain what the application is to... I can't imagine that the law would say you have a right to video but cut out the sound.
But I think here the larger and, as you say, salutary point is that it's good for citizens to be able to record what it is that officers of the law are doing. And at the same time, it's good in general for police officers to know that when they interact with the public, there may be more people watching than would have been the case when they were going through police academy and first learning about it. It's human nature. You give certain kinds of people a uniform and a badge and a gun, and they can become bullies and they can become arrogant. And it's a common phenomenon, and that's certainly not to tar all police officers by any chance, by any stretch. And yet, you know, we know that there are plenty of cases where there are some people who do take the power does go to their head. They do go too far. And as this message begins to seep in, and it seems clearly in the Boston Police Department it is seeping in, you can't stop a citizen from videotaping you or videotaping something that you're doing. You don't have the right to do it. I'd say that that's not a bad thing at all. In fact, I'm open to the idea that it wouldn't be a bad idea for police officers themselves to be wearing body cameras.
Not only for the case like
North Carolina, where you'll end up seeing a police officer doing something terrible or criminal or illegal, but for all the other cases where they are inclined to argue, look, our lives were in danger.
It's protective to the police as well.
I think so.
Right. It cuts both ways. Well, the video, of course, is more prominent, perhaps, because it's coming on the heels of this high-profile protest in the country, many parts of the country, including in Baltimore, against police departments. Today, the state attorney in Baltimore, Marilyn Mosby, said that prosecutors have filed charges against six officers in the death of Freddie Gray. She says this is a homicide case now. Gray, of course, taken to the police custody earlier this month for allegedly possessing a switchblade. He had a spinal cord injury when he was in police custody. He died a week later. So the state attorney said today that officers said that Gray did not have an illegal switchblade, so the officers arrested him without grounds, and they violated police procedure when they were transporting Gray.
Following transport from Baker Street, Mr. Gray suffered a severe and critical neck injury as a result of being handcuffed, shackled by his feet, and unrestrained inside of the BPD wagon.
Nancy Gertner, do you think prosecutors have a good case against these officers?
If I knew nothing else about the case, other than that a man was arrested at time one, put on a van, and when he got out of the van, he had a spinal cord injury, I would say something had to have happened to him that was either an accident, which is an improbable explanation, or some police misconduct. And it sounds like they have at least probable cause. We don't know about conviction. At least probable cause to press charges. You have to understand. I mean, we have to step back again. This is going to go before a jury, and all of the deference to police officers that had formerly been the case, at least before the time we saw cameras, had been in play. Who knows what a jury would do now, but there was some commentator who said you don't get a spinal cord severance from banging your head against the wall.
Mm-hmm. Which sounds right. It's also worth, I don't disagree with any of that, but it's also worth remembering, as we've seen in places like Ferguson and elsewhere, the story changes over time, and what we all think we know today is going to be changed by what we find out tomorrow and the week after and the week after that.
But it is an extraordinary injury. It is an extraordinary injury, which it's not the usual kind of injury, and you wonder what extraordinary circumstances produced it.
Okay. And we should know, by the way, that Marilyn Mosby, I don't know if you know her, Nancy Gertner, but she grew up here in Boston. She says her 17-year-old cousin was mistaken for a drug dealer and killed outside her home by another teenager. I'm sure we'll be hearing more about her background. Her grandfather, apparently a founding member of the First Association for Black Police Officers here in Massachusetts.
You know, I'll just say,
Very briefly, Jeff.
Without minimizing for a second the concern about police brutality or police mishandling of people who've been arrested, you know, Baltimore has the fifth highest murder rate of any major American city. Of all major American cities, Baltimore has the fifth highest murder rate. An enormous number of people get killed in that city. I only wish as much attention were paid to every murder and every killing and every homicide and every fatal injury
David Simon of The Wire in an interview in The Marshall Project suggests that some of the Baltimore's books were cooked. So I don't know about the murder rate. I mean, I think the murder rate is substantial, but I mean, he actually suggested that there were ways in which they were manipulating the data. But in any event, it certainly has a crime problem. The question is whether or not you deal with a crime problem by sweeps, which is what Baltimore police did, or community policing, meaning you had beat cops who actually knew the kids on the block.
Okay, got to move on happily from criminal justice toward, Jeff, one of your favorite issues, economic development. Governor Baker this week halted his planned $1 billion expansion of the Boston Convention and Exhibition Center. He said he's concerned that supporters have overstated the economic impact of the expansion and that debt payments on the project could drain the state's coffers. Jeff Jacoby, thumbs up or thumbs down?
Absolutely thumbs up. And I hope that this turns out to be not just a temporary halt so they can review the numbers all over again, but pulling the plug on a project that should never have been greenlighted in the first place. There were all kinds of questions raised when the first proposal for an expansion started to be floated. Then it was on the point of being pushed through, railroaded through the legislature. Fortunately, there were people like Greg Sullivan, the former inspector general, many years in state government, very adept at diving down into the minutiae of legislative language and bond offerings and all the rest of it and finding stuff in it that's fishy, who is now the director of research at the Pioneer Institute, and say, hold it. There's all kinds of things that are wrong with this bill. So I'm glad that the new governor came in and decided to take a look, and I'm glad that he's now saying let's just pull the plug for the time being and give it a thoroughgoing review. The whole argument that we need to keep building bigger and bigger and bigger convention centers and bigger and bigger bigger exposition centers and build a great big hotel that the state is going to own as well in order to somehow compete with other cities, it's a fool's errand. There's never any end to it. So this is not a project that we need if you're looking for real economic development.
I actually agree. This is
twice.
Somebody marked the calendar.
I mean, I agree. Having been a judge in that part of in the Seaport where the courthouse was, I mean, there are monumental traffic problems there. It really does look like development was permitted willy-nilly. So I actually like the notion of pausing and looking again at this and seeing how it is better used.
The expanded convention center that was going to be part of the proposal for Boston to host the Summer Olympics in 2024, does that mean that this undermines
Some of us are hoping that there won't be a Boston Olympics in 2024 either. But
well, even so, what does a decision like this mean for
well, I don't know, but undermine. I mean, one possibility is you want to look at this as a whole. You want to see how this relates to the other plans in the city rather than letting one part of the city, namely the Seaport District, develop, as I said, willy-nilly, it seems like, without appropriate parking, without appropriate consideration of the traffic. So I agree with Jeff that there should be a pause on this.
Okay, let's turn finally to our hubbubs, those little stories that may not have gotten a whole lot of attention this week but have caught our attention. Yours first, Jeff Jacoby.
Well, we've talked about so many things having to do with crime and justice and the legal universe on the program today. I was struck by a story out of Montana, out of Cascade County, Montana, which is Great Falls. There's a fellow there named Levi Charles Reardon who was wanted by the police. They had a wanted poster out for him. And this being the year 2015, when the Great Falls police put out a wanted poster, they also put it on the internet. They had it up on Facebook. And Levi Charles Reardon is apparently going through his Facebook posts, and he sees the wanted picture, the wanted poster looking for him. He likes it. He clicks that like button. He was promptly tracked down, and he's now in custody, which just goes to one more reminder, they never seem to stop coming.
The long arm or the laws, the long arm of the internet.
It's very hard to be anonymous. You can't go into deep caves anymore and think that nobody's going to know what you're doing, especially if you're on Facebook and looking for people putting up pictures.
It's not only that you can't be anonymous, but also that you can't be intergalactically stupid,
Well,
that's a whole other
that's part that. Of the human condition.
All right, Nancy, right. What's yours?
Well, I mean, this is actually not funny. In one sense, it was a hubbub-less week, I wanted to say, because of the serious things that we saw. I wanted to look at the coverage of Vietnam again, and I'm reminded when I went to Hanoi several years ago, about 5 or 6 years ago, and went to the museum that dealt with the war. When you walk in, there was a picture of a Times Square demonstration against the war in the museum, which was incredibly moving, both that that somehow they knew of our divisions and how our divisions played in the whole content of the war and the whole progress of the war. So I found it incredibly moving, and the coverage of Vietnam has been incredibly moving this week. So that's sort of not funny hubbub. Sorry.
That's
that,
all right.
That, that picture is appropriate in the sense, I would say, as someone who doesn't share the conventional wisdom about the Vietnam War, it's a very apt reminder that the United States lost that war here at home.
Yes.
It wasn't lost
yes.
on the battlefield. It was lost
difference between a democracy, which that reflected, and arguably what was going on in Vietnam at the time. So, no, I thought it was incredibly moving. And that they would post it was interesting as well.
And thank you for bringing it up here. Nancy Gertner, Harvard Law professor and retired federal judge. Jeff Jacoby, Boston Globe columnist. Great to have you both here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is Radio Boston.